Pat, what is happening?
Not much around here. So I get a sense that you are feeling the joys and frustrations of being a classroom teacher for summer school, huh?
It is definitely a change, but what's cool about this summer is I'm teaching as a part of a first-year program in Boston Public called the Social Justice Academy. So essentially, in 5 weeks, we're trying to break down systemic issues like racism, inequality, school-to-prison pipeline, you know, the basics. Actually, last night, I recognized that it would be pretty shameful of me to not highlight the life of John Lewis.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love most about teaching civics is that when something happens, I can just jump right to the computer and write a lesson, and kids feel like the class is relevant and it's responding to what's going on in the outside world.
Yeah, there was so much about his life that I didn't get. Just a few examples that he started this work when he was 21. And actually, even before that, he had tried to attend a segregated university. They actually didn't even read his application. And he wrote to Martin Luther King for help. And Martin Luther King took him out to lunch. And,
yeah, sent him bus tickets and had him come all the way to see him, which is a really cool part of that story.
And then also just everything he did with the Freedom Rides. I didn't fully appreciate the significance of those rides until I watched some of the clips. And probably just like the most crazy thing about it was thinking that how the fuck is the bridge in Selma still called the Edmund Pettus Bridge? It blows my mind.
Yeah, and I think people in that part of the country do put their feet down and kind of are resistant to changes like that. But Pettus was a member of the KKK. You know, I think one of the things that strikes me most about John Lewis was that when he jumped into activism, he knew full well, obviously, that he could face physical harm himself. But his parents had just bought, they were sharecroppers, and then they had saved up enough money to buy a tract of land. And he knew that if he caused enough good trouble, as he called it, his parents could end up losing that land, or his parents could be killed, or his many siblings could be killed.
Right.
Just the bravery that it took for him to get involved and then to face physical harm, knowing that it would turn public opinion to, you know, the side of his cause. Just such an inspiring figure. And with that, folks, welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Hey, so Pat, I understand that this is the last episode of season one. I mean, are we being brought back for a second season? Have we been picked up by anyone? What's going on?
So our sponsors have just pulled the plug. That's the issue. No, so we've brought on some new members of the team here.
And I still have a job?
Yeah, we would not have the comic relief without you in your role. So you absolutely still have a job. We're a four-man team now. So we've got a good friend of mine from when I worked in the for-profit world, Carlos Benitez, and his good friend, Dito, has 20 years of audio production experience. So hopefully these episodes will start to sound more professional, sound cleaner, and Dan, you and I can focus on developing the content of these episodes and landing some pretty cool guests.
Sweet. Let's do it. So we have people with actual skills.
Yep.
Nice. So who do we have on the pod today, Pat?
So we were able to land an interview with State Senator Jamie Eldridge. He has been representing his district, Middlesex and Worcester counties, since 2006. And he was able to stop what he was doing, his busy schedule. They are still in session long enough to do an interview about prison reform, which is something I've admired his tenacity in. He's always visiting prisons and always pushing for more accountability from prison officials and from our entire criminal justice system. But he also talked about a new bill that just passed the Senate and it's going to the House. So on Wednesday of this week, the House should be voting on the same bill or on their version of the bill. And hopefully it still has the teeth that he fought for to make sure that it had. And then it will go to Charlie Baker's desk. So it's pretty exciting to be talking to a state senator just after he had signed a bill that he fought for days to make sure that it really did live up to the calls from the streets for more accountability for police officers.
Yeah, I loved the interview, and I found it really educational. One thing that stood out to me was this. I had never heard of the idea of police officers becoming certified. I think that this is so commonplace. My wife as a massage therapist is certified. You and I are both certified working at schools. Doctors and nurses are certified. It just makes a ton of sense that we all treat our professions as opportunities for continuous growth. And then on the other edge of the coin, it would also make it much cleaner and easier to remove actors like Derek Chauvin, who had something like, 15 dings on his record. You would think that if there was a licensure process, that someone would have been able to challenge him or remove him much sooner, and George Floyd might still be alive.
Yeah, I think there was a whole lot of thought that went into this bill, and I think Senator Eldridge himself can explain it a lot better than you or I can in the lead here. So let's just go ahead to the interview with Senator Eldridge. And folks,
you in season two.
Yeah, be on the lookout for the start of season two, which should be in the middle or towards the end of next week.
All right, folks, enjoy the interview.
Senator Eldridge, welcome to Trickle Down Socialism.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on your podcast. Really appreciate the outreach, Patrick.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you. I remember when I was working on Deval Patrick's first gubernatorial campaign, we were asked to make a number of calls on your behalf. And right before I started calling, I said, wait, do I like this guy? And the campaign manager said, yeah, he's right up your alley. And I will say, from my experience watching you in the Senate, I would agree with that statement. So how's your summer been going so far?
You know, it's been a pretty intense summer. You know, I feel like we've picked up the pace on passing legislation. And of course, on Monday into Tuesday morning, we passed a what I think is a comprehensive police reform racial justice bill. So really pleased with that and hoping to get, you know, it to the governor's desk.
Yeah, I look forward to asking you a couple questions about that. I did want to start with prison reform, which I know from following you on Facebook is an issue that is near and dear to your heart as well. And specifically as it pertains to COVID, my mother-in-law was actually looking at numbers the other day talking to us and said, you know, what's this spike in Shirley? She lives in Groton, mm-hmm. Mass. And I was curious, is that because of the MCI facility there in Shirley?
I think that's a key piece. The MCI Shirley has been a COVID-19 hotspot. I think it has been contained, but because, you know, of a variety of decisions by DOC, you know, there was a real concern that it was going to become even worse.
What can state legislatures do to protect those who are incarcerated here in the state?
Well, there was, you know, there was a real big push by us to make sure that every prisoner had PPE, had access to disinfectant, soap, hand sanitizer. I would say the Department of Corrections did, you know, sort of a mixed job, mixed review on that. And then we were making the point that for prisoners that weren't in prison for violent crimes, you know, were close to serving their sentences, whether they should be released or just, you know, given a ankle bracelet monitor so that they wouldn't have to be so close to each other. But, you know, I think it's accurate to say that Governor Baker has been very much a tough on crime kind of governor and not really supportive of criminal justice reform. So very few prisoners have been released during the pandemic.
We could do more in that front in terms of letting people out if they are not convicted of violent crimes or closer to their release date.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But the parole board, you know, Department of Corrections has really been unwilling to do that. So the only prisoners released is those on medical parole, which means they had a terminal illness, so not really related to COVID-19. So there have been some released, but otherwise no one else has been released from our state prisons.
the last question I have for you on reducing our prison population and prison reform is, what can we do as a state to try to reduce the number of people who are in prison? I've been watching District Attorney Rawlins, and I think her approach is really progressive. I've been impressed with that. But what can we do on the state level?
Yeah, well, DA Rawlins has been a tremendous leader in really carrying out the vision, you know, that she campaigned on, which is always something she reminds people, is this shouldn't be a surprise. This is what she campaigned on. At the end of the day, it really is about state policy. You know, the prison population is going down, and I think the next conversation is whether we're at a point where a prison should be closed, because if we're talking about real savings in the Department of Corrections, it really doesn't happen until prison closes. So that's a conversation that we're having. In a recent bond bill, there was a push by the Baker administration for about $50 million to build a new women's prison by the MCA Norfolk campus. And I was successful in getting language in the Senate bond bill that prohibited any money from going to build any new prison. Because as we know, if you build a new prison, you know, they will come. There will be ways for people to be prosecuted to fill up our jails. And so we need to push back on that and use those resources for, you know, human services, for job training, for people disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. And I think that's a better use of taxpayer dollars.
The interview we had was originally scheduled for last week at this time, but you and your Senate colleagues were really hard at work on a bill, S-2800, the Reform Shift and Build Act. Could you tell our listeners what is, you know, so exciting about this bill?
It's a very comprehensive bill. I would also recognize that, you know, all of the provisions that many progressives were fighting for are not in the bill, but I think it's a very comprehensive approach. It has establishes the post and post-sac state training for police officers and state decertification. So for the first time ever, police officers would be certified, sort of given a state license to be a police officer. And if that police officer violated certain laws or was found guilty of violating someone's civil rights, they will be decertified as a police officer. And I actually got language in the bill that says that they would not only be ineligible to be a police officer, but they would be ineligible to be a correction officer, given some of the concerns in our state prisons. So that's a key piece. The qualified immunity provision, which there was has been an incredible amount of discussion around, and basically just the ability that if someone has had their civil rights violated, you know, a civilian, If a police officer has broken the law, it's the right for any one of us to go to court and sue. You know, this isn't about a police officer personal savings, you know, or property, but it's about the city or town they work for, with the theory that that will push police officers to be more responsible in their interactions with civilians. So that was a key provision that's in the Senate bill. We ban racial profiling, as well as require that for every police stop of an individual, whether, you know, on the sidewalk or a motor vehicle, that person has to be given a receipt or a ticket. And that also includes the race or ethnicity of the person being stopped to get a sense if we're having a problem with racial profiling in any community. You know, in Boston, even though black residents make up just 25% of the city's population, over 70% of stops or stop and frisk policies are against black Americans in Boston. So that's a real concern. We also create the ability for a school superintendent or school committee to no longer have school resource police officers in the schools. That's been a real concern that I've heard from in my district from mostly black and Latino students. You know, some of them don't feel comfortable having a police officer in the schools. So we had some improvements to expungement to make it easier for people to seal their record many years after they've been served their time or convicted of a crime, because it's such a barrier to people, you know, finding a job or going to college. And then we do have more mental health support for police officers. Also looking at, you know, if there is a mental health crisis in a community, how can we make sure that that crisis is addressed by someone who is a mental health professional versus just a police officer coming to that person's house. So beginning the first steps of discussing that. The bill had many different provisions, but those were some of the main aspects of the bill. And in my sense is the House will come out with its version next week, and looking forward to seeing what that debate looks like.
You mentioned a lot of good provisions in that bill. You mentioned also before that some of the more progressive measures did not get passed. Were those some of the amendments that you were pushing for, and why didn't they pass?
You know, people think that the Democratic legislature is progressive. I would describe it as more, you know, center left. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's changing, but it's still fairly slow. And on the Senate side, I did propose an amendment to completely ban chokeholds for police officers. The Senate language proposed was saying that a chokehold was prohibited unless a police officer thought that his or her life was at risk. And the problem with that is that, you know, it opens up the door for chokeholds to be used by a police officer, you know, just saying, well, I thought that my life was at risk. So the amendment I filed, another colleague of mine filed it as well. We had a vote on it, but it was defeated. I think it was 16-23. And so, you know, unfortunately, a lot of my colleagues and in my conversations with police chiefs, they still felt that a chokehold was still an option that they thought that police officers should have. I strongly disagree with that, and I just don't think it should be an option, because we've seen how chokeholds have been used against, you know, George Floyd, Eric Garner, and many other residents. And again, not just Black Americans, but, you know, Americans of all backgrounds. It's just a very deadly tactic. And then around tear gas, you know, while we limited the use of tear gas, it's still allowed under the Senate bill. I would have much preferred it to be banned. You know, you see these really scary scenes, usually in other states, not Massachusetts, of how police use tear gas. And, you know, let's think about the damaging health effects of tear gas if you really take it in and breathe tear gas. I think there are other ways for the police to address public gathering that's getting out of hand than using tear gas or bullets. And then, you know, I would say the final piece where I wish we were stronger is that there isn't much in there around prison reform. I appreciate the fact that the criminal justice reform law that Governor Baker signed over 2 years ago, you know, had a lot of prison reform, but I have dealt so much already this session as the chair of Judiciary Committee with a lot of tensions in a lot of prisons between incarcerated people and correction officers. We're still spending so much money on prisons that could be used for other purposes. And I just think that if we don't address the sort of school-to-prison pipeline, prison infrastructure, you're not really going to address all of the problems that being incarcerated has on all of our society.
Yeah, I am a school teacher. I think you know that, but I teach eighth grade civics in Boston, and I'm really excited to hear that you're working on trying to get school resource officers out of school. I've seen firsthand, you know, kids who are re-traumatized by seeing a police officer when they're at their worst, and so I think, you know, getting more counselors in place, my co-host is a school counselor, would be a much better move there. Is there anything that you learned in this process that could be useful to others, maybe in other states, other legislatures that try to sit down and rethink policing or defund the police?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, I would just say it really takes leadership from the top to get the conversation going. And this is where I really praise Senate President Spilka for, you know, putting together a racial justice working group very quickly, for saying, you know, I want to debate a bill, let's get a bill on the floor and not just do it next year. So I think it takes leadership from the top. I also think, you know, to have more and more police chiefs speak out around police reforms really, really helped our cause. But I would say a lesson, you know, if other states were thinking about this, is that, you know, most legislators don't have a lot of conversations either with their Black constituents if they don't represent a very diverse district, and that, you know, oftentimes there's sort of opposition from police chiefs and police unions to police reform. And that's real. We saw that this week. We're going to continue to see it. And so, you know, for constituents, for concerned residents who really want to push for police reform, they need to be, you know, very vocal. You know, during the debate over the Senate police reform bill, you know, I was reaching out to some of the Black Lives Matter or racial justice groups that have popped up in my district to say, you know, I'm glad that you're having a dialogue at the local level. I'm glad that you're still doing protests. But when there's state legislation that could really alter some of these policies, you need to be engaged and vocal and not just have the other side weighing in against some of the proposed changes in the Senate bill.
So what can our listeners do if they hear this interview and they get excited about what's being done? What do you suggest is the most effective thing for the average resident to do in support?
You know, I think that state representatives and state senators are very accessible, willing to, you know, talk on the phone with constituents, meet with constituents, to have those direct conversations, as well as to have those conversations with your police chiefs. Because if a police chief can get on board with police reforms, which we saw with the Post and POSAC bill, you can really create a change. Whereas if you have police officers that, you know, are against some of the reforms, that, you know, they do have a lot of political power in Beacon Hill and it can stop certain bills.
Okay. And so does the governor support, I mean, I'm asking you to get into someone else's brain here, but what do you think is going to happen when this bill gets to the governor's desk?
Well, I commend the governor. You know, he came out with a post bill of his own around state decertification of police officers. The governor generally offers very little details or opinions on a bill once it's pending. So I hope that once the bill gets to the governor's desk, he will sign it. And a real recognition that, you know, if we're really serious about racial justice and police reform, now is the time when it's really in people's minds. Can we do more? Absolutely. And we should next session, but we need to get this bill to the governor's desk.
Senator Eldridge, I really appreciate you taking 20 minutes out of your day to talk to me. And I will hopefully be able to call you up in a few months or maybe 6 months and get you back on the show here, Trickle Down Socialism. But I appreciate the work you're doing in the Senate.
Great. Well, Patrick, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. It was great to talk to you, and thank you for what you're doing, because it's really getting out the word. Much appreciated.